Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Gender Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Chelsea Gibson, the host of the channel. Today, I'll be talking with Dr. Anna Stevenson, a postdoctoral research fellow in the International Studies Group at the University of the Free State in South Africa. In 2015, she was awarded her PhD in history from the University of Queensland, Australia. Last year, her 2018 Pacific Historical Review essay was awarded the Turrentine Jackson Article Prize by the Pacific Coast Branch of the American Historical Association and the Covert Award by the History Division of the Association for Education and Journalism and Mass Communication. Today, we'll be discussing her new book, The Woman as Slave in 19th Century American Social Movements, which was published with Palgrave Macmillan as part of a series on the history of social movements in 2019. Welcome to the podcast, Anna.
Thanks so much for having me here today, Chelsea.
I'm super excited to talk about this book. I think it's a really interesting and very topical subject. And so what I wanted to ask you to do first was just give us a brief overview of the book for our listeners.
Yeah, of course. So this book is really the first book to develop a history of the analogy between woman and slave across the long 19th century. And it's really most concerned with charting the changing use of the analogy amongst social reformers, as well as a variety of other groups during the 19th century. So this kind of comparison between women and slaves has foundations in classical thought, but it really gained greater political import and significance alongside the expansion of the transatlantic slave trade and the expansion of chattel slavery across the Americas during the 17th and 18th centuries. Most scholars have analysed the use of the woman slave analogy amongst abolitionists and women's rights reformers, and my book also starts here, but it also expands the discussion to other social movements, so dress reform, labour, suffrage, free love, racial uplift, and the anti-vice movements. So this is a really provocative but also commonplace rhetorical device, and it was exceptionally influential during the era of chattel slavery and slave emancipation. Yet my book also reveals that a more diverse array of reformers embraced the woman slave analogy than many have previously appreciated. So as one of the most controversial rhetorical strategies in the history of feminism, I think its legacy continues to underpin debates that are really continue to be influential in feminist theory today.
Awesome. Very interesting. So could I ask you, I mean, this is a very big topic as well. Like it's a very kind of intellectual topic. It required you to go through so many different kind of venues as you just have outlined. So could you tell us like how you came to be interested in this particular idea?
Certainly. So when I was completing my fourth year honours thesis, which is basically an undergraduate thesis, in 2009, I was working on popular culture and popular representations of slavery in literature. And I did a thesis that analysed Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin and Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind. And in the process of kind of reading the historiography of these novels, I came across some of the scholarly analyses of the woman slave analogy, and I just found it fascinating. At the same time, through looking at these novels, I was also starting to look at some examples from 19th century newspapers. So the excellent edited compendium, the Radical Women's Press of the 1850s, was a really important compendium of primary sources, which also kind of introduced me to this kind of strain of women's rights discourse in the antebellum era. At the same time, this honours course introduces you to historiographical analyses, and particularly the work of feminist historiography introduced students to individuals such as Gerda Lerner, who herself really starts to criticise the use of analogy amongst women historians in the 1970s. And so kind of putting all of these elements together just captured my interest to the degree that I wanted to pursue this as my PhD thesis. But from there, I think I wasn't aware that this was going to take me into the territory of also doing really a history of different social movements and their interactions between each other. It just became increasingly evident that this wasn't something that was limited to abolitionists and women's rights reformers. It was also of interest to all of the social movements that I just mentioned, but also others such as the health reform movement also found profound interest in discourses of slavery. And I think this variety is what kind of captured my imagination and encouraged me to continue with this topic.
So you really focus obviously on the woman slave analogy, like that is the title of the book, that is the kind of thread, that the kind of intellectual thread, right, that unites all of these social movements, as you've just explained. So I'm curious what caused you to want to coin your own term. And I wondered also if maybe you could speak a little bit about the function of an analogy itself, right? And the kind of maybe limitations or maybe opportunities of using an analogy, you know, trying to say a woman is a slave. What does that do rather than, using a different rhetorical device?
So one of the things that struck me as I was going through the historiographical discussions of the analogy between woman and slave was kind of the diversity of terminology that had previously been used by scholars to describe the phenomenon. So you have examples such as the sex-race analogy from William Chafe. Lerner uses the slave comparison. Other scholars use phrases such as the slavery of sex, the slave metaphor, the analogy of slavery, the metaphor of bondage. I don't think there's anything wrong with these terms in particular. They do describe the phenomenon that is going on amongst these reformers, but in some ways it makes it a bit of a difficult area to research because you're just constantly coming across different descriptions of what effectively in the 19th century at least is the same thing. I think there's the situation of change over time, so by the 20th century the sex race analogy is much more prominent than the woman slave analogy, but from this I just felt that there was some sort of benefit for scholars to have a discrete term that describes a rhetorical phenomenon that is going on at one particular time and place. But in terms of the function of analogy, I think from an activist perspective, there's something very powerful about using language that is controversial. From an activist perspective, I believe that they think it will capture the imagination or outrage spectators in an audience of antebellum onlookers. But at the same time, that kind of use of outrage is very disingenuous in terms of the way that it focuses attention towards women and draws it away from the experience of chattel slavery. And this is what many scholars such as Bell Hooks, Angela Davis, Elizabeth Spelman have alluded to, and many others. There's also a wonderful essay by a literary scholar, Carla Peterson, who really goes through the pros and cons of use of analogy in the antebellum era. And she explains the degree to which analogy focuses on the sameness of two entities, but it also completely elides the differences between two entities. And sometimes those differences are more important than the sameness. And I think that that is the downside of the way that an analogy functions in reform and activist discourse.
So could you maybe tell us like how the woman slave analogy first occurred, like first developed in the kind of what you say early 19th century, really late 18th, I guess, early 19th century. Could you explain like who was the architect maybe of this idea and how it became more ingrained and maybe institutionalized really in like early feminist rhetoric?
So it really does begin in Europe and Britain. Some of the earliest use of the woman slave analogy is amongst Mary Astell, so proto-feminist thinkers, and also Mary Wollstonecraft. And I think Mary Wollstonecraft's use of this analogy in The Vindication of the Rights of Women really helps it to gain traction, as that book is widely read across a number of decades, really, and it really starts to influence different reformers in different contexts. But I think that the woman slave analogy gained greater traction in the United States just because the United States is, of course, a national context where chattel slavery continues and, in fact, expands into the antebellum era. And so whereas most individuals in Europe would use slavery as an analogy in a way in which they were usually quite geographically distanced from the concept, not always, but in comparative terms, they were more distanced from the concept than in the United States, whereas that is quite a different situation in the United States. And it's really amongst early women in the abolitionist movement, so Sarah Grimke and Angelina Grimke, they, of course, face personal discrimination based on gender. So the unease with which many abolitionist men felt towards having women in the anti-slavery movement. And in this, this is how they start to see the relevance of the comparison to themselves. And then this kind of process of consciousness raising, as Blanche Glassman-Hirst has described it, happens for a number of other abolitionist women. So Lucy Stone, Abby Kelly Foster, a number of others. But by the 1900s rather than the 1800s, which makes absolutely no sense, so I apologize.
That's okay.
the 1850s, a new generation of reformers who have gained their stripes in abolitionism, such as Susan B. Anthony, really start to focus increasingly more on women's rights, and Anthony is, of course, joined by Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And this is, I think, where the use of the analogy really starts to change. It remains connected to social movement discourse in terms of anti-slavery, but it really takes on a new life of its own in a social movement that's dedicated to women's rights.
One of the things that I found really interesting about the book is how you tried to interweave like a lot of differing opinions. So you have the people you would expect, right? Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucy Stone, the Grimke sisters. But you also try to show how African-Americans and even conservative kind of so pro-slavery advocates and later like anti-suffragists, how they also utilize this. And I think that is really interesting because it shows the kind of malleability of the woman slave analogy and kind of its opportunities in some cases as well of its limitations. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about one, how like African Americans understood this, particularly those who had experienced chattel slavery, and then on the other side, the slaveholders who also kind of utilize this woman slave analogy.
Certainly. So I think this is one of the most important things that I wanted to bring to the discussion, that discourses of slavery were just absolutely commonplace in the antebellum era and beyond, and this meant that they had a lot of salience for different groups of people who could describe really a vast variety of topics, experiences, forms of oppression as a form of slavery. often in very like strange and also disingenuous ways. But because most of the scholarship is a necessary criticism of women's rights discourse, I thought it was also important to say that there were other people, other groups, particularly conservatives, anti-suffragists, pro-slavery thinkers, who were using a comparison between women and enslaved people in a far more vicious way, insofar as they were using this comparison to maintain the status quo and to ensure that neither women nor enslaved people would change their status in society, have the opportunity to change their status in society. And so as much as women's rights reformers' use of the woman slave analogy is, I think, very divisive, I think at least they were using it for progressive causes, which is in direct comparison to pro-slavery ideologues, for example. That said, I do think that most white women's rights reformers were using this rhetoric to focus on the oppression of white women implicitly, if not explicitly. And this is really where it's the use of this rhetoric is just completely different amongst African Americans. So in the 1840s, almost did it again, almost said 1940s, in the 1840s, Frederick Douglass is just starting to gain greater fame as a really influential abolitionist on the back of his slave narrative being published. And at this point, he's really unconvinced of the myriad ways in which people are using discourses of slavery. However, he seems to become increasingly convinced that this is a possibility insofar as he starts to use it himself. And this really kind of follows his greater dedication to the women's rights movement and women's enfranchisement. And he certainly doesn't use the woman slave analogy with the same frequency as so many white women reformers, but he and other African Americans certainly do use discourses of slavery to describe the oppression of women. But I think the really important thing here is that they never forget the legacy of chattel slavery. They're not confused about many states of slavery being the same. That is not something that enters their discussion. They know that chattel slavery is the harshest category of oppression, as I think David Roediger describes it in this context of chattel slavery being used rhetorically. But in using the woman slave analogy, they most often focus on the situation of African American women first. And so their analysis of race, gender, and class begins from that point rather than from the point of analyzing the situation of white women first.
Did you find any reformers, this is just a kind of a curious question, like, did you find any white women reformers kind of maybe in the pre, like the antebellum period, who were able to use the language in a way that maybe like Frederick Douglass would, where it was the woman slave analogy also recognized that women's oppression wasn't as great as slaves' oppression, but that they were both on a spectrum of oppressions that they could use to then kind of analyze the structures of society?
I think that the Grimke sisters offer the best example of this phenomenon that you're talking about. And I think that's kind of the result of their own upbringing and situation, that they come from a slaveholding family. They have experienced a society directly in which chattel slavery is just all around. At the same time as they're beginning to gain an awareness of their oppression of women. So I think that the Grimke sisters are much more aware of this kind of spectrum in a way that most later white women's rights reformers either weren't or didn't want to remain conscious of that spectrum.
So what you're kind of suggesting there is the fact that this women's slave analogy changes over time. Could you speak to like how it changes and why it changes over the course of the 19th century?
So I think that this sense of its change over time is what was kind of lost in most earlier analyses of the woman slave analogy. That there's kind of an assumption that it doesn't change. It is the same regardless of whether chattel slavery is codified in law or whether it has been abolished in law. Whereas I think that these legal shifts were actually really important to the way in which many reformers conceptualized the institution. So, and this kind of assumption has enabled me to develop what might be a kind of counterintuitive argument, but it is that the awareness of chattel slavery during the antebellum era did leave most, perhaps not all reformers, but it left most reformers aware that chattel slavery was the harshest form of oppression, and that this did inform their use of discourses of slavery in other analogical contexts. However, with the legal abolition of chattel slavery, I think that this left many white reformers, particularly women's rights reformers and suffragists, with this sense that chattel slavery had ended. Of course, from the historian's perspective, there's many historical works which argue that the legal end of chattel slavery was not, in fact, the end of its influence, that various types of legal, social, voting oppression persisted well into the 21st century. And this, of course, is not a challenge to those arguments, but it is saying that from a reformer's perspective, there was a strong sense that chattel slavery was over, let's turn the page. But this also enabled some white women's rights reformers to come to the sense that if enslaved people were now free, then women, who they also saw to be something of an enslaved class, were not free. And this, from an argumentative activist perspective, enabled them to say, some of them to say, that women are the only slaves left in the Republic. And I think this is, at its heart, the kind of most pernicious aspect of the transformation of the woman slave analogy, because assumptions such as these really, really informed the women's movement over the last decades of the 19th century. And I think it's just one example among many, but a very strong and important example of the racism of the white women's movement in these decades.
So while we're on this topic, you've already mentioned that you've dealt with a lot of feminist historiography when you're kind of coming to this project, specifically like Gerda Lerner and other really well-known women's historians. And so I was wondering, like, what you thought the impact of this woman slave analogy had on women's history as a discipline, just because so many women looked back to the suffragists or to the abolitionists in the 60s and 70s to find, I guess, a usable past. So I'm curious, like, what kind of influence you think it may have had on that kind of new emergence of women's rights and feminism.
So I think the criticisms of historians and feminist scholars such as Gerda Lerner, bell hooks, and Angela Davis are responding to the past as much as they're responding to the present, because the woman slave analogy, as my book details, kind of transforms into the sex race analogy from the kind of post-bellum era onwards. And this transformation really continues and in many ways overtakes the use of the woman slave analogy by the time we've reached feminist and women's liberation movements. But for those feminists and women's liberationists, they're finding inspiration in the civil rights movement, the Black Power movement, and this is the kind of new activist context in which they're finding new analogies to again describe women's oppression through analogy. In the 1970s and the 1980s, I think scholars were also themselves responding to the activists around them and really criticizing the discourses of the activists around them. This made them perhaps much more critical onlookers than onlookers who may have been responding to the use of the woman slave analogy in the antebellum era. but I think it does speak to an important relationship between scholars and the contemporary context in which they're operating. I think that these historians would be able to become quite attuned to the rhetoric of contemporary activists during the 1970s at the same time as they were encountering the historical rhetoric of feminist foremothers, as they were often conceptualized. Mm-hmm.
So I guess one of the things that I would like to have you talk a little bit more about is the difference that you see between like the woman slave analogy and the sex race kind of relationship there, and like why you think that shift is important, or kind of what characterizes that shift in rhetoric.
So I think that this shift in rhetoric is quite a direct response to changing legal codes during the Civil War era, and it's the fact that during the antebellum era, the example from which reformers were drawing inspiration was chattel slavery. But as legislators started to debate changing legal status for freed people, the focus was less on chattel slavery as an institution and more as race as a category of oppression. And as suffragists became increasingly aware that these were debates that were debating manhood suffrage rather than universal suffrage in its most universalistic terms, which would mean enfranchisement for people of any gender too. This awareness that manhood suffrage was being debated in terms of race kind of precipitated the focus to shift to a comparison between sex and race rather than woman and slave. Now, these shifts were by no means absolute. There's, of course, more explicit examples of the sex-race analogy prior to the Civil War, and the woman-slave analogy persists unabated, I would also say, in the decades after the Civil War. But I think that this is still an important shift because it really demonstrates the degree to which suffragists were attuned to these legal arguments, the degree to which some tried to challenge these legal arguments through the Minor versus Happersett decisions, for example. And it also kind of shapes the way that some suffragists hoped for and described the potential of a 16th Amendment for women's suffrage, which, of course, we know didn't take place. Women are not enfranchised until the 19th Amendment of 1920.
Next, I would love for us to talk about, so we're kind of talking about the more contemporary kind of impact of this analogy, but I want to get back to some of the sources and some of the topics that you cover throughout your chapters, and have you talk a little bit about how this analogy worked in maybe marriage, if you could start with kind of talking about how this woman slave analogy influenced people who wanted to, I guess, reform marriage or challenge marriage or keep marriage the same way. Why don't we start with that one?
Sure. So while I've discussed or alluded to a fair few scholars who've criticized this analogy, but I think from a historiographical perspective, one interesting takeaway is that many contemporary legal scholars find that the comparison between marriage and chattel slavery in legalistic terms actually does have some significant viability in terms of the fact that coverture meant that women were completely erased in a legal framework and that their legal identity was subsumed into that of the husband. And the argument is that that is really does have solid comparisons with the lack of legal standing of enslaved people. And I think that this makes the comparison, the focus on marriage a little bit different because it's less ambiguous. It does have legal codes to which reformers could allude to make their descriptions. And of course, reformers such as Elizabeth Cady Stanton were very well versed in the law. They had significant legal understanding, you know, going through family connections. And this meant that they had really solid examples for being able to describe marriage as a state of slavery. This, of course, doesn't capture the differing social experiences of married women versus enslaved people, but I think it kind of indicates the hyperbole that could be used around marriage, because it did have these solid examples, whereas other chapters, particularly the chapter in the book that focuses on fashion, I think that reformers had much less tangible connection to make between fashion as a form of oppression and slavery as a form of oppression. And so that discourse kind of seems to, I don't know, float a little bit more untethered from reality, perhaps.
Could you give the listeners a little bit of the sources or things that you found with that fashion relationship between this analogy, so they could get like a better sense of how kind of maybe seemingly bizarre it seems? Like, I felt like it was a little bizarre when I was reading that, that they were making these types of, yes. types of analogies.
It's very bizarre, but the kind of best source for this is Lydia Sayer Hasbrook's women's rights newspaper, The Sibyl. This is very much a dress reform newspaper, which was the organ of the very fledgling dress reform movement of the 1850s. So the dress reform movement begins with the Bloomer costume, which is popularized by Amelia Bloomer in her own women's rights newspaper, The Lily. And lots of fashion, well, women's rights reformers were very much engaged with dress reform too at the beginning of the Bloomer costumes craze across 1851. And their criticism of fashionable dress was that it encased women, and it was very cumbersome for women, and that its impression on the body was fettering, and that this is kind of where the discourses of slavery come into play. And in a lot of cases, this is not always referring to chattel slavery as an institution. It's using kind of discourses of slavery in a way that is more purely rhetorical. But then during the Civil War, you had dress reformers making many more direct comparisons between the oppression engendered by fashion and chattel slavery. And so I think that's, again, where historical context, like exactly what is going around a reformer, kind of influences the rhetorical movements that they're willing to take.
Yeah, one of my favorite things in that chapter was, I think it's Sojourner Truth, who says, "I've worn enough bloomers. I would like to wear a dress now," too. Like, kind of the way that white women's demands for their own liberation through fashion was sometimes counter to that of the experience of women who had either been slaves or, you know, free Black women, I think, who wanted, you said they wanted the social status of the dress, right? Of that nice middle class or kind of elite kind of dress, which I think is a really interesting kind of point that you made. Could we talk about, is it metempsychosis? Is that yes. How you say it?
I believe that is how you say it, metempsychosis.
I am really interested in how that was, if you could define that first for like our listeners and kind of talk a little bit about how that helped. I don't know how that related to women seeing themselves, I suppose, literally as slaves, right? Imagining themselves.
So there's a wonderful book by Gay Gibson Seema, which kind of delves into metempsychosis as an abolitionist practice. And it begins in the early 1830s with Elizabeth Chandler, who she's really trying to gain greater sympathy amongst abolitionists, but also the spectators in abolitionist audiences, to generate greater sympathy towards enslaved people by getting free people to imagine themselves in the situation of an enslaved person. And the way that she encourages people to do so in the abolitionist newspaper, The Genius of Universal Emancipation, is through phrases such as encouraging individuals to imagine the fetter lying with weight upon their wrists and to imagine their wife and children being whipped, and to encourage free people to imagine these very visceral processes which were thought to characterize slavery, and in which in many cases did characterize slavery. And this this kind of, I suppose, Seema's implication is that this connected free people to the kind of tangible metaphysical, perhaps, experience of chattel slavery than had previously been the case with much abolitionist rhetoric and reform principles. But then this this process gained particular significance for a number of women abolitionists. So there's examples from Angelina Grimke's diary where she engages in these metempsychosis-like personal reflections. Abby Kelly Foster has a very extended passage of imagining herself experiencing an episode of metempsychosis. And I suppose I'm suggesting that these personal embodied imaginaries encouraged women to think of themselves as enslaved in a way that was distanced from themselves. But since they're also using discourses of slavery to talk about their own oppression of women, I'm suggesting that those distancing experiences of metempsychosis were perhaps a bit closer to home than most scholars have previously suggested.
So, like, you're saying that they, by, like, kind of pretending they were slaves, they began to internalize that understanding of themselves as a slave in that way.
To a certain extent. I suppose I'm not wanting to make any strong conclusions except to say that the internalization of imagining yourself in a position of enslavement must somehow relate to the way you're using the woman slave analogy to advocate women's rights.
Absolutely. So one of the things, the metempsychosis thing is so interesting to me, and it makes me want to know a little bit more about how you went about gathering sources for this type of book, because it is so wide-ranging. Like, how did you, one, you probably had to travel to America a number of times to get these sources. I'm just curious, like, what your process was.
So when I began my PhD thesis, I was coming very much from a literary studies perspective. As I mentioned, I completed an undergraduate thesis on Uncle Tom's Cabin and Gone with the Wind. And during my undergraduate majors, I'd focused on literary and cultural studies. So I was very much geared up to do a thesis that focused predominantly on novels and short stories, which certainly resulted. The novels and short stories do play an important role in my thesis and the consequent book. But I also remember that when I was doing one of the early seminars during my doctoral thesis at the University of Queensland, that one of the professors, Andrew Burnell, who was in the audience, had suggested very gently that maybe newspapers would also be a good source to consider here. And because I was coming from this kind of literature background, I'm like, no, I'm not going to look at newspapers. There won't be anything there. But, of course, he turned out to be very right. And newspapers have just provided a wealth of material, particularly women's rights and suffrage newspapers. But you're right. When I began the thesis, I was just working with published sources that I was able to access in Australia. But in 2012, I was very fortunate to be awarded a New England Regional Fellowship Consortium travel bursary, which enabled me to travel to the United States, go to the Schlesinger Library in Boston, the Sophia Smith Collection at Smith College in Northampton, and also to some libraries in San Francisco. And I was all of a sudden able to look at these women's rights newspapers via microfilm, which was an interesting experience. But more importantly, at the Sophia Smith Collection, I was able to look at the Women's Journal, like original hard copies of the Women's Journal, and just page through them, page after page. And that was such a fascinating experience because I'm from abroad. I was all of a sudden in the backwoods of where some of these women lived and operated, and I was reading their newspapers. So that was just a very special experience.
I've done a lot of work with Alice Stone Blackwell. And yeah, and so I have the very similar kind of very visceral reaction when I get to deal with the Women's Journal. Is there anything that really surprised you? I guess we've talked about fashion, which we both kind of understood as maybe the most extreme iteration of this. But is there anything else that you encountered that you thought, wow, I did not expect to see somebody talking about this using this type of language?
I think for me, actually, the most surprising thing is actually just the frequency of this rhetoric, so that you can be paging through the Women's Journal and I'd find myself having to stop and take archival photographs every page. This is, of course, not in every edition of the Women's Journal over its, what is it, 60 years of publication or yeah. something, but like it's still very stunning that this could be used so frequently. And I think that that just speaks to how much it was kind of this undercurrent of women's rights and suffragist discourse by the late 19th century. And because it was so frequent, it just has to have been influencing the way that these activists, reformers were thinking. And I think that that's what I'm kind of trying to get at in terms of describing a woman as slave worldview. I think the woman slave analogy more directly describes the rhetorical device or the literary device, whereas a woman as slave worldview is more a worldview in which an individual is able to see it as plausible and possible that a comparison between women and enslaved people makes sense to them. And I think this frequency is really representative of that.
Yeah, you mentioned, and I believe in your conclusion, you talk a little bit about the opportunities for this analogy to maybe move women more towards like an intersectional analysis. So the Grimke sisters are a good example of that, as you just kind of explained. But I was curious, like, if how this book maybe had you think about the problem of intersectionality in the feminist movement, like today.
So I think from a theoretical perspective, it's important for historians to place certain theories as the product of certain times and places. And intersectionality is coined by Kimberly Crenshaw across 1989 to 1991. And as she developed this theoretical approach, it's to offer a paradigm to understand the connections between different forms of oppression, particularly derived from gender, race, and class, but also other forms of oppression. So pivoting from intersectionality, which has become a very influential and significant and important theory for feminist studies, I thought it was worthwhile to describe the woman slave analogy as kind of a failed theoretical intervention, that not all theories are successful, some are actually bad, and from my perspective, the woman slave analogy can very productively be described in terms of this failure of women's rights discourse and the long history of feminist thought. But at the same time, I think that the contestations that arose from analogical reasoning kind of over about two centuries began to push feminist thought in different directions, so that there was suddenly, finally, an impetus to sidestep analogical reasoning altogether and find new ways to describe the connections between different forms of oppression that have ultimately been far, far more successful from both a scholarly perspective but also an activist perspective.
Yeah. I'm curious too, because this type of analogy doesn't just appear when we're talking about women. And this kind of person slave analogy or group slave analogy seems to never go away, at least in American society. I mean, we see it right now in the signs that people are holding up in COVID-19 protests. And, you know, I'm really curious as to how you go about analyzing something that seems to be such a large part of American culture, at least. I mean, you talk about how the Enlightenment had this kind of discourse. Just kind of curious if you could talk more broadly about this function of this kind of blank slave analogy throughout the time that you were, I guess, doing your research.
So certainly this has enduring implications in American culture. The discourses of slavery are very prominent from the Republican era onwards. And even though I think they go out of style here and there, as you say, they do have enduring significance. But I think it's also important to again return to Carla Peterson's emphasis on the degree to which analogy emphasizes sameness but elides difference, and that this lack of clarity here actually isn't always the best way for activists to put forward an argument. So I think that historically, the use of the woman slave analogy, as I've described it today, suggests that it actually didn't manage to convince a lot of people of the oppression of women. That in some ways these suffragists and women's rights reformers were preaching to the choir, because perhaps the activists around them were convinced of the woman slave analogy, and perhaps the readers of the revolution became convinced of the woman slave analogy. But the fact that others were using this rhetoric in different ways actually suggests that the use of analogy is not necessarily beneficial to your cause. And in fact, analogy raises more questions than it answers. And so I think that this is kind of an important takeaway for activists of whatever stripe, really, who continue to use analogy and particularly discourses of slavery today.
Well, that is a I think, a great note to kind of end on. But right before we kind of sign off, I wanted to let you talk a little bit about whatever project you're working on right now. Like, what's the next? I don't know if I want to say the next book, because you just got done with this one. But could you tell our listeners a little bit about what new research you're embarking on?
Certainly. So I am working on a new book project, but very long time in advance, I think. But it's to persist with the analysis of the woman slave analogy, but not the woman slave analogy alone. So I'm interested in doing a kind of broader history of transnational feminist thought, which will span the United States, Britain, Australia, and South Africa. And I'm based in South Africa, so I'm very glad to be able to bring South African feminist thought into the discussion. And it's to chart the way that different forms of analogical reasoning emerged in different contexts, and often in response to different histories, different national histories. So in the US, chattel slavery can quite productively be thought of as in terms of a historical analogy. But in other times and places, feminists seem to derive inspiration from different histories. So in Australia, a greater awareness of the history of colonization and convict transportation and Indigenous dispossession by the 1970s inspired some feminists to pursue the sex colonization analogy. And then, even though feminist thought was, or feminist activism was far less evident in South Africa during the apartheid era, because anti-apartheid activism was so prevalent, by the 1990s, you see some South African feminists, as well as feminists elsewhere, begin to pioneer the gender apartheid analogy. And so the broader focus of this project is to trace how these different race-based analogies emerge in different times and places, how they respond to different historical contexts, and how they operate in different contexts too, and persist into the 21st century. So I'm very excited about this project, and I'm not sure where it'll take me, but I'm enjoying working on it.
Well, it sounds very ambitious, so I wish you the best of luck as you kind of span the globe in your research. So I just want to say thank you so much, Anna, for having the conversation with us today. I would highly recommend your book out your book to everybody out there. It's really fascinating, and it's structured so well that you can read a chapter at a time and they really feel kind of discrete yet interconnected. They're great for classes, I would say, I think.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. All right. Just to reiterate, we were talking with Anna Stevenson. She was the author of The Woman as Slave in 19th Century American Social Movements. Thank you so much, everybody out there in New Books Network, for listening. Goodbye.